You could have somebody, you know, do a closed caption, you know, transcribe every word. I can speak slowly if that would help, you know. Well, I don't actually don't know if I could or not. What are you laughing about? Okay, we are going to go ahead and start in here, and it doesn't do me any good to say so, but for our folks in the live stream, I think there are some audio technical difficulties. They may not be able to hear what's going on, at least at this point, so we'll continue to work on that. But for everybody here, there are handouts, and I've enlisted Hayden to pass these out. So if you had not already printed one off from the website and haven't already received one from Hayden, then flag him down. He'll get you those. And he's also going to be running the microphone. So remember, for our purposes of a good class flow, if it's something short, quick response, just throw it out there without raising your hand or waiting for the microphone. If you do have a longer response, and I'll leave it to you to discern what that means, but if you have a longer response, do raise your hand and wait for the microphone to come to you so that everybody in here can hear you, for starters, and then if and when we're able to have audio for the live stream, people at home can hear you as well. Okay, with that out of the way, we're going to jump right in and pick up our story of Gideon and then Abimelech in Judges chapter 8. Now, this is an important class. I guess they're all important, but in one specific sense, I find this particular class to be important, which is that this is a part of the Judges story, particularly a part of the Gideon story, that I would propose we're not as familiar with. We ended, I'll not say that because I want to ask you how the story has gone so far. What happened so far in the story in Judges 6 and 7? We started in chapter 6 with the oppression of the Israelites by the Midianites. They were brought low, plundered, so on and so forth. So, then you tell me quickly, what were the main events of the story so far in Judges 6 and 7? Where do we go from this oppression?
It was a victory over the Midianites by Gideon with his 300 men, and with the Lord's help, they were able to reign victorious over the Midianites.
Okay, thank you, Terry. And what else would you say, details that you would fill in about maybe Gideon in particular and his own personal journey, if we want to say that? Gideon did not want to do it, Shannon says. And how did he get there then? How do we get from Gideon didn't want to do it to what Terry said, which is the Lord gave him the victory? Yeah, and I think basically we've covered all the main things here. Gideon is called in chapter 6. He's very reluctant. We've talked about the Moses parallels. And then, I use the same word Albert did, patiently leading, God helps Gideon's courage to rise. Now, it's interesting, you could think about the word testing in a couple different ways. And on one hand, Gideon is testing God to an extent. I mean, we know that there is a version of that that God condemns. But in a sense, Gideon is asking God for signs, and God is fulfilling that. Remember, there's also a part of the story where God is putting Gideon to the test and giving him tasks to accomplish that will help to build his character. Like what? What was maybe the first thing that Gideon was tasked with doing? Remember, he was afraid to do it, so he did it covertly instead of publicly. Yeah, tear down the Ashtaroth and the Baal of his father's house. So, again, it goes both ways, but God, through all this, is being patient. Gideon's courage is slowly rising. More Israelites are coming to his aid. God is sending Israelites home to say, no, we need to have the army down to 300. And with that 300 men, God gives the victory. Now, remember the thinking behind that in chapter 7 of Judges verse 2 was, The Lord said to Gideon, "The people who are with you are too many for me to give Midian into their hands, for Israel would become boastful, saying, 'My own power has delivered me.'" So that was the purpose of the smaller army, was to ensure that God got the glory for the victory, not Gideon or not Israel. Okay. And that ended, all of that ended with the slaughter, the killing of two of the Midianite leaders, Oreb and Zeb, which takes place at the end of chapter 7. Okay, in all of this, what would you say to this question? What kind of judge is Gideon, as we have read in Judges 6 and 7, in this first part of the Gideon story? What would you say? What kind of judge is Gideon? He's a good judge. Valiant warrior.
Obedient. Needed a little faith.
Needed some faith. Is there maybe a positive aspect to that that character quality of Gideon that we see serving him well, perhaps, in these two chapters? Yeah, and if we're going to speculate, perhaps do some pop psychology, I mean, Gideon's reluctance, his unsure nature, wanting to be more sure, what might that have provoked in him that's a positive character quality? And we should notice how many times, 6 and 7, and I think that does tell us something about Gideon's attitude as he goes into all of these, you know, various challenges. Okay, now here's what I was going to say earlier. You may have not remembered that there's more to the story than this. You may have kept reading in chapter 8, or you see, you know, look down now in chapter 8 and say, oh wait, there's more to the Gideon story? I thought the Gideon story was 300 men, they win the victory, we're done, we can all go home. And yeah, there's a whole other chapter about Gideon, and that's why I say, as I said at the beginning, I think a class like tonight is important for understanding maybe a less familiar part of the story and seeing how there is more to the story. I don't know if it's a Paul Harvey kind of thing. You can tell me by the end of class. Here's a map real quickly of what's going on. So this is where the main action takes place. Ophrah here is Gideon's hometown and where the initial part of the story happens. That red circle is where the battle takes place. Right below that on the river Kishon in the valley of Jezreel is Herod's spring or Herod's well where the men drink from. They have the battle here, and then as we'll see in tonight's reading, the Midianite leaders flee and cross the Jordan here trying to get back to where their home base would be, and that is where Gideon and his men are going to pursue them. So let's read in chapter 8. And notice that the first things that we have are, I put beef in here. Again, that's mainly just so that I could get a short enough word to all fit on one line. Complaints. There are conflicts here, personal conflicts. Ephraim has a complaint against Gideon. Gideon has to, resolve their dispute. The town of Succoth, the town of Penuel, they're going to put up a fight against Gideon to some degree, and Gideon will respond to that in a certain way. So think through those two conflicts, those two complaints, how Gideon handles those things, describe the battle as it is told to us, and then think about how does Gideon handle all this, and do we like the way, or would we speak favorably of the way that Gideon handles himself in these first 21 verses as the rest of the battle concludes. Judges chapter 8, verse 1, "Then the men of Ephraim said to him, 'What is this thing you have done to us, not calling us when you went to fight against Midian?' And they contended with him vigorously. But he said to them, 'What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God has given you the leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, into your hands, and what was I able to do in comparison with you?' Then their anger toward him subsided when he said that. Then Gideon and the 300 men who were with him came to the Jordan and crossed over weary yet pursuing. He said to the men of Succoth, please give loaves of bread to the people who are following me, for they are weary, and I am pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian. The leaders of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hands, that we should give bread to your army? Gideon said, all right, when the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will thrash your bodies with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. He went up from there to Penuel and spoke similarly to them, and the men of Penuel answered him just as the men of Succoth had answered. So he spoke also to the men of Penuel, saying, when I return safely, I will tear down this tower. Now, Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor, and their armies with them, about 15,000 men, all who were left of the entire army of the sons of the east, for the fallen were 120,000 swordsmen. Gideon went up by the way of those who lived in tents on the east of Noba and Zogbeha, and attacked the camp when the camp was unsuspecting. When Zeba and Zalmunna fled, he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and routed the whole army. Verse 13, then Gideon the son of Joash returned from the battle by the ascent of Heres, and he captured a youth from Succoth and questioned him. Then the youth wrote down for him the princes of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. He came to the men of Succoth and said, behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, concerning whom you taunted me, saying, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give bread to your men who are weary? He took the elders of the city, the thorns of the wilderness, and the briars, and disciplined the men of Succoth with them. He tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. Then he said, verse 18, to Zeba and Zalmunna, what kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor? And they said, they were like you, each one resembling the son of a king. He said, they were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if only you had let them live, I would not kill you. So he said to Jether, his firstborn, rise, kill them. But the youth did not draw his sword, for he was afraid, because he was still a youth. Then Zeba and Zalmunna said, rise up yourself, fall on us, for as the man, so is his strength. So Gideon arose and killed Zeba and Zalmunna and took the crescent ornaments which were on their camels' necks. Okay, let's maybe bypass the answering of the factual questions that I've asked you and just go straight to the interpretation or the evaluation here. What do you want to say about how Gideon presents himself, how Gideon acts in this second movement of the story that involves the chasing down of the two Midianite kings? Brian?
Given to him, I'll repeat, he's just completing the task that God had given to him. He's routed the army, and now he's going to kill the two kings and in fulfillment of all that God had asked of him. And in the process, he asked Succoth and Penuel to feed his army, of which they refused because he had not subdued the two kings. He's not done.
Okay, thank you, Brian. Other thoughts about how Gideon handles himself in chapter 8 so far? Albert?
Much more confident with making this much more confident and going somewhat appearing of being rogue in some of his decisions and or penalties and consequences. As we'll get to later on, I think.
Do you mind maybe elaborating what you mean by going rogue?
The judgment called for upon Succoth and Penuel, we don't have that God gave him that go-ahead, but he was quick to make it, and so I don't have fact to back that up. And then Ephraim, in talking with them, it was more of a politician kind of answer and stroking. So I just get the sense that he's taking a lot of decisions on his own. And then as we see later that his last decisions caused problems for him and his household. So I don't want to give it away too much or not necessarily give it away.
Spoiler alert here by Albert. Yeah. We'll get to all that. So maybe I'll pose this question. And I don't want to spend too much time on this, but should we view Gideon favorably in the way that he deals with Succoth, the way that he deals with Penuel? Or maybe even somebody wants to venture to talk about how he involves his son in the slaughtering of the two Midianite kings. Is chapter 8 a favorable presentation of Gideon or not? Brian says mixed bag, which I guess that's, fair enough, easy answer. Terry, what do you got?
The only other thing that would make you wonder was when he was talking to the two kings and he says, who did you kill in this particular place? They resembled the princes. And he says, if he didn't kill them, I would have let you live. So that's the other thing that because they were to kill the kings, in this case, the kings of Midian, the Oreb and Zeb.
And that response is, I think it is interesting. And we'll come back to the idea of kingliness that Terry refers to. But I do think we do at least want to keep in mind or notice that in verse 19, Gideon says, those were my brothers. Okay, kind of revealing, I mean, again, maybe you can tell me if I'm taking this too far, seems to reveal that this whole mission here is more, in chapter 8, about personal vengeance than anything else. Because he's saying, hey, you killed my brothers, I'm going to hunt you down at all costs and kill you. Okay, now, maybe you say there's more to the story than that, and I'm fine with that. But it does at least reveal that there is a motive of vengeance, whatever else is motivating Gideon as well. A couple of things I'll notice. I'll take a little bit of a different stance than Albert. I do think in the episode with the men of Ephraim that were like, hey, why didn't you call us to the battle in the first place? I do think maybe especially compared to the other, contrasted with the way he handles other disputes, maybe this is a Proverbs 15:1, a soft answer turns away wrath kind of thing. Remember back in chapter 7, so this is the question I'll present to you. Remember back in chapter 7, the phrase that they announced, they shouted when they went into the battle against the Midianites was a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. I read chapter 8 and I ask the question, is this a sword for the Lord or is this just for Gideon? Maybe, again, there's at least a question about how much of a personal motivation there is. And then somebody pointed this out that I read and I thought it was kind of interesting. You have that scene where Gideon has his son who's young, I don't know how young he is, but he says, you kill these guys, and he's afraid, he doesn't want to, and so Gideon does it himself, and one author, suggested maybe this, his son is a picture of who Gideon used to be, mild mannered, not very confident, afraid, I mean, Gideon himself was afraid, it told us that in the text explicitly in chapter 6, and maybe it's a picture, maybe you could say of Gideon's positive evolution, maybe you could say that Gideon has maybe left his mild-mannered, meek temperament and has become something else, maybe somewhat monstrous in some degree at least. Okay, so let's keep going here. And Albert alluded to the rest of the story of Gideon, so let's read that and talk about it. As we read here to the end of the chapter 8, again, this is a lot of this is about evaluating the story of Gideon and how he's presented. Gideon's going to say some things, he's going to do some things. Are his words and actions contradictory? And then notice where this goes in Israel after the time of Gideon and think about maybe where we put the blame or how we would explain what happens in Israel after Gideon. Verse 22, then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son, also your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. But Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. Yet Gideon said to them, I would request of you that each of you give me an earring from his spoil. For they had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites. They said, we will surely give them. So he spread out a garment. Every one of them threw an earring there from his spoil. The weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and the purple robes which were on the kings of Midian, and besides the neck bands that were on their camels' necks. Gideon made it into an ephod and placed it in his city, Ophrah, and all Israel played the harlot with it there, so that it became a snare to Gideon and his household. So Midian was subdued before the sons of Israel. They did not lift up their heads anymore, and the land was undisturbed for 40 years in the days of Gideon. Then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, the son of Joash, went and lived in his own house. Now Gideon had 70 sons who were his direct descendants, for he had many wives. His concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, and he named him Abimelech. And Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a ripe old age, was buried in the tomb of his father Joash in Ophrah of the Abizrites. Verse 33, then it came about, as soon as Gideon was dead, the sons of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. Thus the sons of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side, nor did they show kindness to the household of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in accord with all the good that he had done to Israel. Okay, the people's response after the battle is what? Yeah. No, I mean, right here, the beginning of where we read here, the two kings are killed, the battle's over, and the people say what to Gideon? Rule over us. And Gideon says, no, yeah, he says, I will not rule over you, my son will not rule over you. You know, the author is saying, yeah, keep reading. But God will rule over you. Okay. That's a good answer, right? I mean, we won't hash that out. That's a good answer. And in some ways, that is the answer or the one of the thesis statements of the book of Judges, okay? They didn't have a king, so it was chaos. But in the end, God should have been their king. And he was their king, or at least ought to have been the one ruling over them. And had he really been ruling over them, or at least had they been submitting to him as their king, things would have been much better. So Gideon gives the right answer. I will not rule over you. God will rule over you. Yes, Steve.
Yeah, his words were humble. His actions weren't. That's the thing that stands out to me when I think about him. He says he doesn't want to be their king, and yet that's exactly what he's pushing for. He's very competitive, I think, with Ephraim. I think there was a lot of competition in there. That ephod and all that may have very well been a competitive venture on his part, but he was really a lot about Gideon. And I think leadership can have that kind of an issue if they're not careful. The fact of the matter is they can come across real humble, but the fact of the matter is that they're about their own desires and their own direction.
So the ephod is one thing. In fact, the way the text is phrased in verse 24, the first word after his humble statement is yet or but. Okay, so you wonder what the author is doing there. Yet Gideon said, "Okay, so no, I'm not going to be king, but you can." And did that remind you of anything? Give me all your jewelry. I'll collect it from you. We'll make something out of it.
Wilderness.
Yeah, it sounds like Aaron in the wilderness, right? And so Steve points to the ephod episode. Hard to know exactly what that was, but clearly it was some kind of object that ended up being an idolatrous snare for the people, okay? That doesn't look good on Gideon, even with his humble words. Steve alluded maybe to other things, but didn't say anything specific. So what else would you say in this passage? What are some of the other actions of Gideon that appear to perhaps be contradictory to his words? Brian?
After making the ephod, which initially does not appear to be sinful, I think it's more of a symbol of the power of his office that he assumed. He allows it to become, in some particular way that I don't understand, a form of idolatry. And he allows that to proceed. He didn't stop it. And ultimately, you could see whether it would or would not have happened on its own, clearly the people, after his death, declined into Baal worship again.
And that verse 27 does seem to place blame to some degree on Gideon. It became a snare to Gideon and his household. Again, Brian's right. There is some question about how this all transpires. But the author, you know, names his name in that statement. What else would you say? What about in Gideon's retirement? You know, he goes to his home. What's the rest of his life like? Lots of wives, okay? Yeah, so what do you think of when you think lots of wives and as Granny mentions, you know, even at least one, or if not more, from foreign lands, okay? What does that remind you of? Yeah, that's what kings do, okay? 70 sons, okay? You know, and yeah, I think it's fair at least to say that Gideon's actions are not in line with his words. And the sons, the harem, that is, you know, all the wives and the concubines would be an example of that. And then here's the kicker. It mentions already, because it's a preview of chapter 9, and that he had a son named Abimelech. Does anybody know or have a footnote? What does the name Abimelech mean? Remember Abba, Jesus says that. Abba means father, yeah, there we go. Melech is a little bit harder. There's Ebed-Melech in Jeremiah, but like Melchizedek.
It means my father.
Yeah. I remember I had a friend, my friend and I went back on this. It's like, well, did the father name him or did the mother name him? You know, it's kind of like maybe there's just the mom that was, you know, trying to say, hey, I'm the concubine of a king. I'm going to name my son Abimelech. But it is suspicious, at least, that Gideon, who says, I'm not going to be your king, names his son, my father is king. So again, I think the author is dropping these hints to show us a difference between what Gideon is saying and what Gideon is doing. And you could maybe even read that back into the conversation with Zeba and Zalmunna. What do they mean when they say, oh yeah, all those guys looked like you, Gideon. They looked like the son of a king. Well, what made Gideon look like the son of a king? Maybe he was tall, maybe he was like Saul, you know, big and buff like me. You know, you'd probably think I'm royalty, you know, big frame, muscular guy. Maybe Gideon was dressed in such a way that they said, oh yeah, they kind of looked like you, Gideon, like they would be the sons of a king. So it's interesting how that all goes. But I want to get into the Abimelech story because, again, that's lesser known. But here's your map again, and they go across. These are the two towns that Gideon disciplines on his way back. And then they return, you know, to Ophrah. That's where Gideon spends the rest of his days, where the ephod is set up, so on and so forth. But the Abimelech story is going to take place down here. So up here, you know, around Mount Gilboa is Gideon's hometown, but Abimelech is, you know, grows up with his mother in the town of Shechem. That's his territory, and that's where we start the story in chapter 9. Okay, chapter 9, 1 to 21, think about how does Abimelech gain his power. And there's going to be a parable that's told. So keep up with the fable or the parable and try to think about what it means. Chapter 9, verse 1. And Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, went to Shechem to his mother's relatives and spoke to them and to the whole clan of the household of his mother's father, saying, speak now in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem. Which is better for you, that 70 men, all the sons of Jerubbaal, rule over you, or that one man rule over you? Also remember that I am bone, I am your bone and your flesh. And his mother's relatives spoke all these words on his behalf in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem, and they were inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is our relative. They gave him 70 pieces of silver from the house of Baal-Berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless fellows and reckless fellows, and they followed him. And then he went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal, 70 men on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left, for he hid himself. All the men of Shechem and all Beth Millo assembled together, and they went and made Abimelech king by the oak of the pillar which is in Shechem. Now, when they told Jotham, he went and stood on top of Mount Gerizim and lifted his voice and called out. Thus he said to them, listen to me, O men of Shechem, that God may listen to you. Once the trees went forth to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, reign over us. But the olive tree said to them, shall I leave my fatness with which God and men are honored and go wave over the trees? Then the tree said to the fig tree, you come, reign over us. But the fig tree said to them, shall I leave my sweetness and my good fruit and go to wave over the trees? Then the tree said to the vine, "You, come reign over us." But the vine said to them, "Shall I leave my new wine, which cheers God and men, and go to wave over the trees?" Finally, all the trees said to the bramble, "You, come reign over us." The bramble said to the trees, "If in truth you are anointing me as king over you, come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, may fire come out from the bramble and consume the cedars of Lebanon." Verse 16, "Now therefore, if you have dealt in truth and integrity in making Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house, and have dealt with him as he deserved, for my father fought for you and risked his life and delivered you from the hand of Midian, but you, risen against my father's house today and have killed his son, 70 men on one stone, and have made Abimelech, the son of his maidservant, king over the men of Shechem because he is your relative. If, then, you have dealt in truth and integrity with Jerubbaal and his house this day, rejoice in Abimelech and let him rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and consume the men of Shechem and Beth Millo, and let fire come out of the men of Shechem and from Beth Millo and consume Abimelech." Then Jotham escaped and fled and went to Beer and remained there because of Abimelech, his brother. Okay, how Abimelech gains power I think is fairly straightforward. So what do we want to say about the parable? What is this business with the trees and reign over us and the bramble and all that? What's the message of the parable? Brian? Or Tom?
Least qualified, the least respected gains power.
Well, it seems to me, this is my own judgment, I didn't read a commentary on the curse of that's pronounced here, but the people ended up choosing the least and the worst of all people to become their leader, and which was not according to integrity and resulted in their destruction. And that's what they've done here with Abimelech, the briar, the bramble.
Why do the olive tree, the fig tree, the vine, why do they not want to be king? Yeah, it's the same reason why there's no, you know, decent people that want to be president or want to be, you know, it's like they're living good lives. They're doing good for their world and they're enjoying the benefits of that. Why leave that to do something as Albert says, dirty and as difficult and as treacherous as be king, right? But the bramble says, "Hey, yeah, I'll do that." And so the statement of Jotham is clearly, "Hey, look, you need to know what you have gotten yourself into." Notice that in verse, I'll just give you this in. Chapter 9, verse 7, it says that Jotham goes to the top of Mount Gerizim to deliver this parable. In Deuteronomy 27, Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal are the two mountains that they stand on and pronounce the blessings and the curses of the covenant of Israel. So there is some significance. Jotham, in some way, is playing the role of the prophet. Although, notice he is not really saying, God is holding you to this. What is Jotham's basis? Like, he's rooting his argument in something to say, you're doing wrong by fill in the blank. And what is Jotham saying? You're doing wrong by what? Is he saying you're doing wrong by Jehovah and asking Abimelech to be your king?
Did wrong by the house of Gideon.
Yeah, what he says is, you have basically, thrown off, have taken advantage of, have repaid very poorly Gideon and his household. Gideon, the one that did all this for you, now you've killed his sons and made the son of his concubine the king, and basically says, this is what you're getting into. You have gone to the bramble for shade, and in the end, you're going to not only get stuck, but you're going to get burned. There is this interesting principle where oftentimes the people that desire leadership, at least in a worldly sense, are not really the best kinds of leaders. Maybe you've experienced this in your own life, that oftentimes it's maybe even like Gideon, like Moses, I don't know. Oftentimes the people that are very reluctant to be in a position of leadership are the very people you want to be in a position of leadership, because that reluctance is a sign of their humility, of their integrity. This is, you know, Prince Caspian in the Chronicles of Narnia tells Aslan, "I don't think I want to be king." And Aslan says, "Well, that's exactly why you're going to be king." Because there does seem to be a connection between that humility, that reluctance, and the pure and good character qualities. And that gets back, I think, to something Steve said earlier about the way that leadership can, for someone with the wrong motives, become an opportunity for selfish desire. And so oftentimes leadership attracts people that are in it for the wrong reasons. And so you have an example of that here in an extreme way, of course, with Abimelech seeking this out, killing others. And Jotham says, congratulations, you've made a deal with the bramble. Yeah, Albert.
Reminds me, and maybe I'm stretching New Testament, where, you know, the baptism of, and when it's posed to the Jewish, you know, so he's presenting this to them. They're condemning themselves depending on which way they go. It's either condemning Abimelech and, we were deceived, or you called for this murder. We have laws against that. So it's, they're in a very difficult spot based on this little parable that he's given to them.
Yeah, and I think that's the idea of the difficult spot is what Jotham is emphasizing. He says, either you're going to take shade under a bramble, which doesn't sound very pleasant, or the fire's going to come out and get you. Either way, if Abimelech is like straight up about this, then it's still not going to be very good for you. But more than likely, there's going to be treachery involved and it's going to burn you. Let's read about that and look at the rest of the story. It'll be a longer reading, and we're running a little bit low on time here, so this will take up a few minutes, but I want to read this and just think about how these events play out. Think about the parable of the bramble and maybe how it is fulfilled or how it plays out in the actual events in the rest of the chapter. And then do think about this third question. It'll be said at the beginning of this reading, at the end of the reading. What is God doing in all of this? What is his purpose and how is he accomplishing it? Judges 9:22. Now Abimelech ruled over Israel 3 years. Then God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, and the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech, so that the violence done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might come, and their blood might be laid on Abimelech and their brother who killed them, and on the men of Shechem who strengthened his hands to kill his brothers. The men of Shechem set men in ambush against him on the tops of the mountains, and they robbed all who might pass by them along the road, and it was told to Abimelech. Now, Gaal, the son of Ebed, came with his relatives and crossed over into Shechem, and the men of Shechem put their trust in him. They went out into the field and gathered the grapes of their vineyards and trod them and held a festival, and they went into the house of their god and ate and drank and cursed Abimelech. Then Gaal, the son of Ebed, said, "Who is Abimelech and who is Shechem that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Jerubbaal, and is not Zebul his lieutenant? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem. But why should we serve him? Would, therefore, that this people were under my authority. Then I would remove Abimelech." And he said to Abimelech, "Increase your army and come out." When Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, the son of Ebed, his anger burned. He sent messengers to Abimelech deceitfully, saying, "Behold, Gaal, the son of Ebed, and his relatives have come to Shechem, and behold, they are stirring up the city against you. Now, therefore, arise by night, you and the people who are with you, and lie in wait in the field. In the morning, as soon as the sun is up, you shall rise early and rush upon the city. And behold, when he and the people who are with him come out against you, you shall do to them whatever you can." Verse 34, "So Abimelech and all the people who were with him arose by night and lay in wait against Shechem in 4 companies. Now Gaal the son of Ebed went out and stood in the entrance of the city gate. And Abimelech and the people who were with him arose from the ambush. When Gaal saw the people, he said to Zebul, 'Look, people are coming down from the tops of the mountains.' But Zebul said to him, 'You are seeing the shadow of the mountains as if they were men.' Gaal spoke again and said, 'Behold, people are coming down from the highest part of the land, and one company comes by the way of the diviner's oaks.' Then Zebul said to him, 'Where is your boasting now with which you said, "Who is Abimelech that we should serve him? Is this not the people whom you despise? Go out now and fight with them." So Gaal went out before the leaders of Shechem and fought with Abimelech. Abimelech chased him, and he fled before him, and many fell wounded up to the entrance of the gate. Then Abimelech remained at Arumah, but Zebul drove out Gaal and his relatives so that they could not remain in Shechem. Verse 42, now it came about the next day that the people went out to the field. It was told to Abimelech. So he took his people and divided them into three companies and lay in wait in the field. When he looked and saw the people coming out from the city, he arose against them and slew them. Then Abimelech and the company who was with him dashed forward and stood in the entrance of the city gate. The other two companies then dashed against all who were in the field and slew them. Abimelech fought against the city all that day, and he captured the city and killed the people who were in it, and he razed the city and sowed it with salt. When all the leaders of the Tower of Shechem heard it, they entered the inner chamber of the temple of El-Berith. It was told Abimelech that all the leaders of the Tower of Shechem were gathered together, so Abimelech went up to Mount Zalmon, he and all the people who were with him, and Abimelech took an axe in his hand and cut down a branch from the trees, lifted it and laid it on his shoulder. Then he said to the people who were with him, "What have you seen me? What you have seen me do, hurry and do likewise." All the people also cut down each one his branch and followed Abimelech and put them on the inner chamber, set the inner chamber on fire over those inside, so that all the men of the Tower of Shechem also died, about 1,000 men and women. Then Abimelech went to Thebez, and he camped against Thebez and captured it. There was a strong tower in the center of the city, and all the men and women with all the leaders of the city fled there and shut themselves in, and they went up on the roof of the tower. So Abimelech came to the tower and fought against it and approached the entrance of the tower to burn it with fire. But a certain woman threw an upper millstone on Abimelech's head, crushing his skull. Then he called quickly to the young man, his armor bearer, and said to them, "Draw your sword and kill me, so that it will not be said of me, a woman slew him." So the young man pierced him through, and he died. When the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, each departed to his home. Thus God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father in killing his 70 brothers. Also God returned all the wickedness of the men of Shechem on their heads, and the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal, came upon them. Okay, let's talk about this third question briefly, and I'll point out some things from the chapter. What is God up to in this chaotic series of events in chapter 9? What is God up to? What is God's purpose that he is working out in chapter 9 of Judges? Yeah,
just more kind of the concept of you reap what you sow. Kind of like at the very end, he said that God made all of the evil of the men of Shechem return on their heads, is that he's just kind of righting the wrongs that they had done.
The Latin phrase for that, you know it, Daniel? This was a thing when I was, you know, your age, but lex talionis, that is the Latin phrase. It means the law of the tooth. And that is a way to refer to the law that's in Exodus as well as in Leviticus, right? That the penalty, the proper penalty for transgressions against the law, specifically in reference to injury and damage of property, was an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And remember, that's not a law about revenge. Remember that. That was simply the measure that God used for the judicial system to dole out the proper punishment, okay? It's amazing, though, how many times in Scripture God himself uses the law of the tooth in order to do exactly what Daniel said. That's the New Testament phrase that we could assign to this. You reap what you sow. And so oftentimes stories are told with particular details to match up to show us how God is enacting his justice on those that have wronged. And specifically in this chapter, it tells us that he is avenging the deaths of the sons of Gideon. So notice that Abimelech's coup, and this was predictable, right? If the men of Shechem are just going to give themselves to some strong man that comes along and says, "Hey, you know, follow me," then what's to keep them from following the next guy that comes along and says, "Hey, follow me," which is what this Gaal character does. And so that, you know, Abimelech gets, in some ways, reaps that from the men of Shechem. Shechem sets an ambush against Abimelech and his company. Abimelech does the same thing. And so again, you have this fire that consumes each other. This is the big one. This is the take-home one here. why mentions of stones? Why does it say that Abimelech killed the sons of Jerubbaal on one stone? What does that even mean? Maybe there's reference to a sacrificial thing there. But how does Abimelech die? Well, one big stone gets dropped on his head by the woman at the tower in Thebes. And so the even the manner of death shows that God is enacting justice using lex talionis, we would say, and Abimelech reaps what he sows. The men of Shechem in many ways reap what they have sown by going into league with Abimelech in the first place. And as the parable had foretold, the result is fire that burns everybody. Can't play with fire and not expect to get burned. Okay, we will stop there and pick up on Sunday with the lessons learned from the Gideon-Abimelech story, and then get into Jephthah, and that starts in chapter 10. Thank you so much.